Body. Before I begin the lecture now, we're going to start with a commercial, even though this isn't a television program. Starting next month, in June, I'm going to be giving two courses for the Mises Academy. One of them is called Political Philosophy Throughout the Ages. And here what we're going to do is we'll be looking at some of the classic works in political philosophy. And as you know, in libertarianism, either doesn't believe in the state at all, that libertarians think we can get along without a state, or there are some libertarians who believe in a strictly limited state. So I like to say libertarians believe in at most one state, just like W.V. O'Quine said about Unitarians. Unitarians believe in at most one God. So libertarians believe in at most one state. So what we're going to do in this course, we're going to see what do some of the great classical philosophers say about the state and when is force justified and other issues, and then we'll look at some of the libertarian arguments also. And now the other course I'm going to be giving is on Atlas Shrugged. This is one of the most best-selling novels of all time. And it's the central work, of course, in Ayn Rand's objectivist philosophy. Previously I gave a course on objectivism, but I think this is a more enjoyable way to learn about the objectivist philosophy. I'm not an objectivist myself, but I think there's a lot to be learned from this book, and we'll go into both the philosophy of objectivism in the course as shown in the novel, and then we'll examine how the book relates to Rand's theories of fiction and aesthetics, and also consider some of the critical reactions to the course. So those are the two courses I'll be giving starting at the beginning of June. But fortunately, for me, we're still in May now, so I don't have to worry about those courses until June. Now, what we're going to be doing in the lecture today, this is, I think, one of the most, what we'll talk about today, the chapter is one of the most characteristically Rothbardian chapters in Rothbard's History of Economics, History of Economic Thought. As you've seen from the reading so far, Rothbard makes no bones about which people he likes and which people he doesn't like. It was clear he doesn't like Ricardo's economics at all. He doesn't have much to say bad about Ricardo as a person. He really doesn't like Ricardo's economics. And when we were talking last week about the money and banking chapter, it's clear which theories he's in favor of and which theories he's against. Now, in the lecture today, which is on John Stuart Mill, who was a central figure in 19th century British economics, the most important 19th century British economist after Ricardo, Rothbard is very clear. Not only does he reject Mill's economics, he doesn't really like Mill at all as a person. He really doesn't care for Mill's personality. And we want to know, when we're considering why he doesn't like Mill, this tells us a great deal also about what sort of person Rothbard was. We can see what traits personality traits he's attracted to, and which ones he doesn't like. And his complaint against Mill is not that just that Mill has the wrong views that he has, as we'll see what the issues are. Mill was basically Ricardian economics. Rothbard thinks Ricardo's views are all wrong. But what he doesn't like about Mill is he regards him as a woolly thinker, not someone who is very precise and exact. And he thinks he had trouble making up his mind, that Mill was always dithering. He would say, well, I'm not sure about this, or let's consider this other point of view. And he wasn't someone who would come down on one side or the other of a conflict. And if you know Rothbard, if you read Rothbard, you know you're never in doubt what side Rothbard is on when he's writing. So Rothbard liked people to be decisive, to come down with a definite point of view, not someone who had trouble making up his mind. So what one point Rothbard particularly critical of Mill about is he said what Mill would try to do was, supposing there were conflicting points of view on an issue, and let's just take an example. Mill's father was a very strict utilitarian. Utilitarian, remember, someone who believes in, you decide what's good by adding up the pleasures and pains that action, various alternative actions would cause, and you choose the one that has the greatest balance of pleasure over pain. Now, if you take Mill's father, James Mill, was utilitarian, but some people, like the great poet and literary critic Samuel Taylor Coleridge, criticized utilitarianism. They said this was kind of a superficial view. It reduced higher values to really units of pleasure. It didn't really consider adequately the complexity of life. So what did Mill do? Well, he tried to incorporate Coleridge's views within his own system. He wrote a very favorable essay on Coleridge, which was unusual for someone from a utilitarian background. He tried to incorporate this and kind of say, well, the utilitarians, like his father, were right, but also this other point was right too. So he would try to put everything, all the different sides, within kind of a synthetic theory. Remind me, you'll forgive me for one of my characteristically bad jokes. There was one where there was a judge who was listening to a case, and after the prosecution finished, the judge said, that's a very good case. You convinced me the defendant is guilty. So the defense attorney jumped up and said, Your Honor, this isn't fair. You can't say that my client is guilty without listening to my defense. That isn't right. And the judge said, what you say is completely right. I agree with you. You're 100% right. Then the court clerk couldn't stand it anymore. He said, Your Honor, you agreed with the prosecution, and you also agreed with the defense, but you can't agree with both of them. And the judge said, and you're right, too. So this is the kind of thing that Rothbard was objecting to. Now, one thing I think we should notice, there are two different complaints here. One is that Mill had trouble making up his mind, and the other is that he would try to incorporate conflicting points of view within his own opinion. Now, those are two separate complaints. I mean, somebody could have a view when you're faced with conflicting theories, you should try to come up with some new theory that incorporates both into your point of view. And it wouldn't follow from that that you had trouble making up your mind. Now, on the other hand, you could have trouble making up your mind and not try to incorporate both sides. It could just be you would just have trouble deciding which one you wanted to accept, but you wouldn't include both of them. But so what Rocker is saying is Mill did both. And one way I suppose you could have trouble making up your mind is by putting both the theories in the same, just having a theory that just consists of the two contradictory theories in an unrelated way. But that might be one way you could show you had trouble making up your mind. But we should be clear there are two separate complaints there. Now, I just wanted to include, this is one of my favorite passages in Rothbard's book, what he says about Mill. It's much better the way he says it than I try to explain it. He says, John Stuart was the quintessence of soft rather than hard core, a woolly-minded man of mush in striking contrast to his steel-edged father. You can see which one Rothbard likes there. John Stuart Mill was the sort of man who, hearing or reading some view seemingly at utter variance with his own, would say, yes, there's something in that, and proceed to incorporate this new inconsistent strand into his capacious and muddled worldview. Hence, Mill's ever-expanding intellectual synthesis was rather a vast kitchen midden of diverse and contradictory positions. I would say this is not an expression of complete enthusiasm for John Stuart Mill. Now, I think it's interesting that although Rothbard and Karl Marx were about as far apart as you can get in economic doctrine, Rothbard was a great defender of laissez-faire capitalism, Marx is the founder of what he called scientific socialism. Marx had a similar view of Mill. Marx thought that Mill was a superficial thinker, and he particularly attacked Mill for combining contradictory elements in his economic system. And one example that Marx stressed in his own account of Mill was that Mill, on one hand, defended Ricardo's view that profit or interest is a residual. What does this mean? Well, remember, we talked about that a couple lectures ago when we were talking about Ricardo's system. Ricardo says everything, that income is divided among, first there's the rent on land, then you have payments, wages paid to labor, and he has theories that explain each of those. Rent is a differential depending on the fertility of the land, and then wages depend on the price of corn. So you have what determines rent and wages. And then interest, your profit, what the capitalist gets is what's left over. So really, there isn't an independent determinant of the rate of interest or profit. It's just what's left over after the other factors of production get their share. So that view, profit is a residual. Now, another economist we didn't talk about in the previous lecture, Nassau Sr., he had the sort of the rudiments of a time preference theory. He said, look, the capitalist is advancing money to the other factors of production. The capitalist doesn't get paid until the product is sold, but he has to pay the factors first. If you're a laborer, you normally don't have to wait until the product is sold before you get paid. You get paid for the period of time that you're working, not when the product is sold. So Senior said that the capitalist is waiting to get his money. He's saving up, and he's abstaining from consumption. Instead of spending his money right away on consumers' goods, he's invested it in production. He's advanced money to laborers, and he's rented land. So he's abstaining from consumption. So that's why you get the reward. So the real basis of this view is that if you're willing to postpone getting your money, you get a premium, because money now is worth more than money in the future. There's a rate of discount. So Senior said that profit is a reward for abstinence from consumption. Now you can see it's very difficult, if not impossible, to say that both that profit is a reward for abstinence from consumption and that profit is a residual. But Mill did say both of those. So Marx saying, look, Mill is defending contradictory views. Incidentally, Marx made fun of Senior's view. What he said was, he just kind of misunderstood what Senior was saying. Senior's really saying the capitalist getting paid because he's taking his money later rather than getting it now, so there's a discount for time. But Marx fastened on the word abstinence, and he pictured, look at these very wealthy capitalists, these multi-millionaires, and Senior's saying, picturing there's some sort of ascetics who are abstaining from consumption, but they're really living very luxuriously. So he's making fun of Senior, but of course that wasn't what Senior meant, so that didn't stop Marx. But in any event, regardless of what he was right about Senior's view, he pointed out a contradiction in Mill's system. Now, as we saw in the quotation, Rothbard contrasts John Stuart Mill unfavorably with his father, James Mill. And what he likes about James Mill was that James was a tough, what a consistent cadre type. Mill had organized a party of thinkers and politicians who would support the programs he favored, basically, like utilitarianism, philosophy, Ricardian economics. He actually developed a lot of Ricardian economics that we saw in the lecture on Ricardo's system, and also political democracy. So Mill was very consistently in favor of those things, James Mill. And John Stuart Mill was more wishy-washy. But one point Rothbard makes is an interesting point. He says, although John Stuart Mill sometimes deviated from his father, he eventually came around to something close to his view. Now, I see there's a question here from Steve. Could you say that a cadre type is an activist or organizer? Yes, I mean, that's what we mean. A cadre is kind of a group, usually a political group who are organized around some, to promote some goal. Let's say that Lenin viewed the Bolshevik Party as a cadre of people who were supposed to advance communism. So that's what the term means. Okay, so according to Rothbard, Mill sometimes deviated from his father, and he had a very different temperament from his father. It didn't really alter his views that much. And here are a few examples. Now, one I mentioned already a little bit. As I said, James Mill was a strict utilitarian. You remember, the utilitarian is one who says you calculate all the pleasures and pains, and that tells you what to do to try to maximize the pleasure over pain, consider all the alternative actions, but which of these alternative actions would give you the greatest balance of pleasure over pain, that tells you what to do. So James Mill was very strict about this. Now, as I said, John Stuart Mill was impressed by the criticism of Coleridge, and other people said that, well, utilitarianism is flattening out everything, because it said anything is just reducible to different units of pleasure and pain. So what Mill did was he distinguished lower and higher pleasures. He said something like, well, the pleasures you would get from thinking about philosophy are higher than the pleasures, say, sensory pleasures, say, pleasures you get from eating food that you like. And it isn't just that the higher pleasures give you more units of pleasure than these lower pleasures, but they're really differences of kind between them. So here he's deviating from his body's utilitarian, but he's still a utilitarian. He's still saying, well, you consider these higher pleasures, but you're still trying to maximize utility. Now, there's all sorts of disputes about exactly what kind of utilitarian was did he think we should concentrate on getting the best possible rules and try to give the rules that if everybody adopted them would maximize utility, or was he concerned more with individual actions like his father once said, which action will maximize utility. But the point here is whatever side one comes down on this dispute, Mill was a utilitarian. He modified what his father said, but he didn't abandon his father's views. And similarly, and this we'll be discussing in more detail later in the lecture, Mill was, just like his father, was a Ricardian in economics. He was a follower of David Ricardo. He had, we'll see, there's a crucial modification he made to Ricardo, but he was still a Ricardian. So he's like his father. He's still like his father. He makes a few changes, but he still has the same doctrines, even though he has a very similar, very different personality type. He's a wishy-washy person. His father is more decisive, but he doesn't stray from the nest all that much. And then another example is James Mill believed in democracy. He believed in it. One person, one vote, and this was basically for utilitarian reasons. He thought, remember, utilitarianism and his style of utilitarianism add up all the pleasures and pains from the various people. Now, how are you going to do that? Well, it's hard to do, not impossible. You can't perform experiments on everyone to see what will give people pleasure and what will give people pain. But what you can do, kind of as a proxy for doing that, is say, well, if a majority of people vote for something, that's at least some indication that it'll promote, they think it'll promote their happiness. So James Mill had a utilitarian argument for democracy. Now, Mill, in his book called Considerations on Representative Government, was somewhat critical of democracy. He thought if you have unlimited democracy, then the uneducated will have undue influence. So he favored ways of giving the people he considered the educated ones more influence, say, giving them more votes than people who weren't educated. But he was still a Democrat, so he had the same pattern that he modifies what his father said, but he doesn't abandon it completely. Now, from the way I presented Rothbard's interpretation of Mill, Rothbard is faced with a problem. What is the problem? Well, from the way Rothbard presents Mill, he's really a very inept person. He's a bumbler. He can't make up his mind. He's combining all sorts of contradictory views, and he's a wishy-washy person. But how, if he has all those bad points, how did he get to be so influential? He was the dominant economist for after Ricardo, until basically in England, at least until the 1870s, he was really the most important British economist. Mill lived from 1806 to 1873, and after he started writing on economics, he was the dominant figure. So how could someone with the character, personality characteristics that Rothbard attributes him get to be so influential? Well, one thing to realize is that Mill had acquired a great reputation through his system of logic, which came out in 1843, that people regarded him as a great philosopher. And I think one thing I don't know that Rothbard would agree with me on this. He really doesn't discuss his philosophy too much, other than what he says about economics. He has some things to say about, we'll talk about later on, Mill on economic method. But I think Mill really was a great philosopher. He had very interesting things to say on some of the standard philosophical problems and theory of knowledge and ethics, metaphysics. So he really, he was a, even though he had all these personality traits that you wouldn't think would lead somebody to be influential, he was considered a very important thinker. People respected him, so that's one of the reasons they took his views on economics seriously. And another point Rothbard made, that he had a very impressive style. Rothbard contrasts John Stuart Mill with David Ricardo, who had a very crabbed style, it was very hard to read, but Mill had a very good style. Now actually, if you read Mill, he had a good style. If you like very long sentences, Mill would have, sometimes have sentences that could last for about a paragraph, but everything would be very exact and balanced and worked in. They all made sense, but if you read Mill, it requires some concentration. I think people today, their students, they might find it a bit hard to read because he had very long, involved sentences. Now, now we can come to what exactly did Mill do in economics? What was his main, what were the main rudiments of the doctrine? What was the, what did he do? Well, here we need some background. Before Mill's book on economics, which was Principles of Political, which was called Principles of Political Economy, which came out in 1848, Ricardo's system had come under attack. Now, one of the keys to Ricardo's system was his theory of rent. Remember, in Ricardo's theory of rent, people will first occupy the most productive agricultural land they can find, and then when they used all that up, they'll go on, and people want to cultivate more land, will go on to land that's not as good, and then when that land is all taken, they'll go on to land that's still not good. So they'll keep going, and according to Ricardo, as land more and more comes under cultivation, people will cultivate worse land. So in Ricardo's theory, the rent is a payment for the superior productivity of a better land. So rent is a differential between the better land and land that isn't so good. Now there were few writers who attacked this theory of rent. Two of the most important were someone of rather odd name, Perronet Thompson. Another one was Richard Torrens, who was also called Colonel Torrens. He'd been in the army. So what they pointed out was when you have, say you're getting the rent in price just like other prices, land is a good that people are using. So say when you pay for a good, you pay something for the value of that good. You don't just pay for how much better it or worse it is than some other good. Say let's say I go out and buy food. Let's say I buy some apples at the fruit store. Well, I'm paying for how much the apples are worth. I'm not just paying how much apples are worth more than oranges or more than bananas or less than some other kinds of fruit. I'm paying for the good itself. So rent, they said, well, rent is a payment for how the value of particular land, not just it's how good, what its relation is to other land. Also, they said, Ricardo had gotten the direction of causation wrong. People value certain goods that can be produced from the land. Say that land will be valuable because it produces crops that people want to buy. So it isn't that because you have valuable land, that means that what you produce is more valuable. The causation is the other way around. It's the price of the goods are valuable. What you're going to get from the land is valuable. And that's determining what the value of the land is. So they said Ricardo got the direction of causation wrong. So his theory of rent is wrong. Now, another writer, Samuel Bailey, criticized Ricardo's theory of value. Remember, Ricardo said that for commodities, let's say commodities, reproducible commodities, commodities that you can have more than one unit of, the value depends on the number of labor hours required to produce a thing plus an addition for the rate of profit. So Bailey said this wasn't right. That value, the price, doesn't depend on the number of labor hours required to produce something, but on subjective utility, on how much people value it. And he also said Ricardo was wrong, and here's an interesting kind of a little bit opposite to the criticism of theory of rent. Remember, the people who criticized theory of rent were saying Ricardo was wrong just to take rent as a differential, that there's a value to a particular piece of land apart from how its value, whether it's better or worse than other land. So here Bailey said, well, Ricardo is wrongly taking to the value of a good to be absolute, based on the number of commodity to be absolute, based on number of labor hours required to produce it. He said, what the value of a good, if it depends on subjective utility, well, we value goods on a scale of preferences. We prefer one good to another. So how much we value a good will depend on its value relative to another good. Now, that's consistent with the other criticism saying that rent isn't differential, because if you say value is relative, you're not saying the value consists of its difference from the other goods, but you're saying value depends on its place in the hierarchy, but you're not saying the value just consists of the difference between the two. So those aren't contradictory criticisms, you see. So, as I say, Bailey said Ricardo's theory of how the cost, how price of goods are determined are wrong. Now, as I already mentioned, Nassau Senior attacked Ricardo's theory of profit. He said profit isn't a residual, it's the reward for waiting or absence. So we have attacks on theory of rent, theory of profit, also theory of value. Now another the Irish economist Richard Whately criticized the Malthusian views that were implicit in Ricardo's theory of wages. Remember, Ricardo thought that wages are really subsistence wages, because if workers get more than subsistence, then they'll just start reproducing more, so wages will be driven down to the rate of subsistence. But of course, they can't go below the rate of subsistence, because they wouldn't survive below that. So wages are really dependent on the cost of subsistence, and this in turn is principally determined by the price of corn, the price of food that the workers are eating. Now this view, as you can see, is dependent. If you say wages, if they go above subsistence, they'll be forced down as people start reproducing, is dependent on a Malthusian view that population will just tend by keep increasing as much as it can. So if people are able to reproduce more because they earn more money, they will. But Whately said people don't respond mechanically in this way. People can decide, well, I've got more money, do I want to just then say, well, I can support more children, so we're going to have more children. Maybe they don't do that. Maybe they'll just say they'd rather have a higher standard of life and fewer children. So if this is right, you can't get the kind of the law that Ricardo wanted. Sometimes people call it the iron law of wages, that wages can't really vary much above subsistence. So people are really attacking Ricardo on all fronts, but despite these criticisms, Mill was able to revive the basics of the Ricardian system. First of all, he accepted Ricardo's theory of rent. He had the same theory I just explained, that rent is based on the differential productivity of land. And he also basically accepted Ricardo's account of wages. Now, he did modify it a little bit. He had some room for labor union activity to raise wages, so he didn't think wages were as rigidly determined by subsistence as Ricardo did. And also, and this was the point that Marx really let Mill have it for this, he accepted Ricardo's theory of profit, where profit is the residual, what you have left after rent and wages are subtracted from income. But he also was sympathetic to the view of Senior that profit is a reward for abstinence from consumption. And it's not clear how he thought you could combine the two, but he did in various parts in his principles favor both of these views. Now, he also accepted the Malthusian theory. Remember that the population is growing, tends to grow faster than the subsistence. So there's a population, and then population grows faster than the food supply. So there's always a pressure on the population. People will keep reproducing until they're checked by the famine or disease or war. So it's a rather pessimistic view that food supply can't keep pace with population growth. But one way that he modified Malthus stressed when he said there's a population grows geometrically, say we start off with the first two people, then they'll have, say they have children, and say we could have, say they have four children, then each of the children will have children of their own, so we can get the geometric ratio that will always be increasing geometrically. but food supply doesn't increase that much. We just have, we can add to the food supply, but we don't have extra new people, something like equivalent, say, in population, have new people who can go on to have children of their own. You don't have that same thing in food supply. You can just increase the food by a similar rate to what's gone before. So Mill pointed out, well, we don't have to accept these. It isn't always the case that population rises geometrically. Sometimes food can grow at faster rates than it has before. So he threw out this geometric versus arithmetic ratio, but he still thought that population will tend to grow faster than food supply. Now, one point that Rothbard especially stresses is that Mill rejected Samuel Bailey's advances toward a subjective theory of value, and he returned to the cost reduction position that Ricardo had, where it's not, the value of goods isn't dependent on how their utility to people, but depend on their cost of production. Mill would certainly acknowledge that if a good doesn't have utility, then it wouldn't have a value, but he didn't think that value, subjective value, to have utility to someone to qualify as a good at all, but once you do qualify, it's something else, namely cost of production, the return of the price. Now, one thing I mentioned when we were talking about Mill's Malthusianism, restricting population was actually one of Mill's biggest causes, one of the things, the social reform he was most interested in. He said, well, we've got to stop people reproducing, especially lower class, uneducated people. They're having too many children. This is creating all sorts of problems for society. So we've got to restrict people. We've got to try to prevent people from breeding too much. And as a young man, he was actually in jail for a short time because he was distributing birth control pamphlets. At that time, the Church of England was very strongly opposed to birth control. That was regarded as an immoral activity, artificial birth control. So you weren't allowed to, if you defended that in public, you could be imprisoned. And Mill was, I think, jailed overnight because he was distributing birth control pamphlets. And Mill was, in order to promote his goal of population control, he was willing to accept restrictions on liberty. For example, he thought that people should have to get a license from the government if they wanted to have children, and that the government would be able to determine whether they're qualified. So it's ironic that he gives this proposal in his essay of 1859 on liberty, which is considered one of the classics of the defense of liberty, but it has a very unlibertarian proposal in it, namely strict population control. And even some of Mill's followers were rather shocked by this. For example, there was one man, Frederick Harrison, saying this is not liberty at all, but Mill was very strongly in favor of population control. Now, Mill's success in reviving the Ricardian system, this is an example for Rothbard. It shows what's wrong with the Whig interpretation of science. Remember, in the Whig interpretation, that's the phrase that historian Herbert Butterfield used, everything is getting better and better. Say we know in economics more today than we did in the 18th century. And since economics began, we've kept learning more and more. This is kind of a general picture of science. Science is always progressing. So Rothbard, as we said in a number of the previous lectures, doesn't accept this. He said there can be science and economics can develop in the wrong way and people can make mistakes and progress isn't continuous. And this is a key example for him because he thought economists were starting to find out what's wrong with Ricardo. They're knocking out his system. They're showing the theory of rent is no good, theory of wages is no good, theory of profit no good. So it looks like this is Ricardo's going to be sent back, sent packing, but Mill comes back and says, no, Ricardo was basically all right. So this is the direct contradiction to the Whig interpretation here. Now, as I mentioned, although Mill was a Ricardian, he accepted all these views from Ricardo, like the theory of rent, cost of production theory of value, and so on. He had one crucial difference from Ricardo. Mill thought there were no laws of distribution. What do you mean by that? Well, suppose we want to know what, say, what wages people should get. So one view is this is determined by economic law. Say Ricardo had that view. The wages are determined by the price of corn, because corn is what will determine the most important determinant of subsistence, and wages are always driven to the rate of subsistence. So Mill rejected that. He thought that there weren't any laws about distribution. So this really opens the door to labor unions, because a labor union can say, well, we can demand more money. You can't say to us there's some economic law that's fixing what the price of labor should be. It's really is a matter to be decided by bargaining. So Mill, by saying there's no laws of distribution, is really opening it up to people to decide how income is to be distributed. Now, although he says other things that seem inconsistent with that. Say, how could you say there are no laws of distribution if you accept Ricardo, basic elements of Ricardo's system in which there are laws of distribution? So it's not, again, it's not clear how Mill thought he could believe in both, that he both accepted Ricardo on rent and basically accepted a good deal of what Ricardo was saying on wages and on theory of value, but he still thought there were laws of distribution. So I think we can see what Rothbard meant when he said that Mill was rather muddled, or quite a bit muddled in his thinking. Now, so far, Rothbard has been very critical of Mill. We want to ask the question, did Mill get anything right, or did he have any good ideas? Or is Rothbard going to be just saying he's completely wrong? It would have been better had he been just blotted out completely. Well, one thing that Rothbard does agree with Mill is that Mill says the demand for commodities is not the demand for labor. He thought that was a very true statement. But it's not immediately clear what does this statement mean, demand for commodities and not demand for labor. What this means is that when people pay for goods and services, say when I go out and buy something, this isn't the direct source of what the wages for the people who make what I buy. Say, if I let's take the example I use. If I buy, if I go down to the grocery store and let's say buy some fruit, my payment isn't the direct source of how much the laborers in the store are getting. Now, why is that? Well, we covered the point already a little bit in what I was saying when I was talking about Senior's theory of profit, is that wage, that workers and the other factors of production are paid out of the funds the capitalist has previously accumulated. They aren't paid out of current sales. So it isn't say that when I go down to the store and buy some fruit, then out of that I'd spend $5 in the store. It isn't that the cashier takes some of those $5 out of the cash register and gives some to the laborers. The laborers are paid ahead of the sale. So the capitalist is paying the workers, the other factors of production, right away, and then he has to wait for his profit until he gets anything. He has to wait until what he produces is sold, and then he gets what's left after. If there's more money taken in and he's paid out in cost, then that's a profit for him. So this statement that let's go back to again so we can see it again, the demand for commodities, not demand for labor, that's the fundamental point again, Warren King, in the great famous 20th century economist. And what King said was that in the case of depression, consumer spending should be increased and this will generate more employment. So if Mill is right, increasing consumer spending won't directly generate more jobs because employers are paying the workers from money they've invested. Possibly there could be some indirect way where consumer spending could lead capitalists to invest more, but there's no direct connection between the consumer spending and workers being paid or other factors of production being paid. Now, besides views about particular theories in economics, like how factors of production are paid, or what the nature of rent is, and particular views of economics, Mill also had ideas about the proper method we should use in studying economics. And as usual, Rothbard thinks that what Mill said was all wrong. Now, the correct method, according to Rothbard, is the one defended by Nassau Sr. In this view, economics starts with certain truths that are given to us directly because of our knowledge of human action. Now, those of you who read Mises will say, oh, isn't this just what they do? Is done in praxeology, when Mises starts with the concept of human action and draws consequences from it. And of course that's right, and Mises was very influenced by Senior, and he actually wrote an essay on an article on Senior's method of economics. So it's really the way Senior wants to proceed is the way Mises proceeds, is the way they're doing it in Austrian praxeology. For example, Senior said everyone aims to increase wealth, whereby wealth he didn't just mean money, but he meant a higher position on the person's scale of preferences. So you're all, say if you have actions that are available to you, you're always going to choose the one that you rank highest, so you're always trying to get to a higher position. And from the basic truth, other propositions are deduced. So that's the basic method of economics. Now, Ricardo also followed the deductive method, but what he started from weren't causal statements about the world, like the people that age increase wealth. I noticed this time I spelled causal correctly. I had it in the previous lecture, casual, someone pointed out, that this kind of managed to get it right. I deserve something for that, don't you think? Maybe not much. So in Ricardo's system, we deduction, but you don't start from causal statements about the world, you start from mathematical identity. So he's not able to have a causal realist science in the way that is the way that Senior pioneered it in Austria. Now, Mill thought, had a different view, Mill thought that economics begins from hypotheses about the world. Instead of saying, here is some truth that is given to us, we just make a certain assumption. Say, an assumption, an example of assumption made is that people want to maximize their monetary income. And this is the famous assumption of economic man, homo economicus. So he's starting in economics, we're assuming, according to Mill, everybody wants to maximize his monetary income. So if you deduce what happens on the assumption of economic man, you will arrive at truth only to the extent the hypothesis is true. Right? So I should say, you're guaranteed to arrive at truth only to the extent the hypothesis is true. So if you start with a false hypothesis, you might by accident arrive at true statements, but you're not guaranteed to have true statements if your statement is just partially true. They'll just take over the partial truth of your assumption. That's all you can be sure about. So Mill didn't, when he said that we have to assume, so Louis said Mill did not agree with him. Yeah, that's right. He definitely didn't agree with him in that, first of all, he thought we're starting with hypotheses, not with truth. And Mill didn't think that it was fully true that people want to maximize their monetary income. Just that this is what we're starting with in economics. Just this is the hypothesis we're starting with, and so it just gives you a partial truth. So if we want to know the whole truth, we have to combine what we get from economics with other investigations, and we'll get a fuller picture of the world. Now, when I was responding to Luis, I mentioned one. This is one difference from Senior, but there was another difference, is that not just that he started with hypotheses instead of truths that are given to us that we know to be true. Mill didn't think all that much about deduction. He didn't like deduction all that much. He wrote a lot about it. But he basically thought that deduction, say deductive syllogism, doesn't really tell you anything new. He thought, for example, let's take an example. Suppose we take kind of the most famous of all syllogisms, we say, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Well, it seems like we deduced the conclusion Socrates is mortal from our premises, so this shows deduction can lead to knowledge. But Mill said, well, how do you know the premise all men are mortal is true in the first place? You couldn't know that unless you already knew that Socrates was a man, because it says all men are mortal. So if you can't say that unless Socrates, who's a man, is mortal, so you wouldn't know the truth of the major premise, all men are mortal, unless you already knew the conclusion. And I don't think that argument works. When I gave my logic class, we went into this point, but regardless of whether that Mill was right, that was his view. So he tended to downplay deduction. He stressed more inductive inference. He thought all truths are really inductions from experience. We just say, things have happened a certain way in the past, and this gives us grounds for thinking it will continue to happen that way, that we've got a law. But he downplayed deduction, so that was the basic difference on method he had from Senior, and Rothbard thinks he was mistaken. Now, one thing I want to go into also, and this is another way that Mill very strongly deviated from a libertarian laissez-faire position, is that Mill, like his father and other utilitarians, had very definite policy goals. And one of the one of his policy goals had to do with his strong support for the British Empire. Remember, the Britain in the 19th century was the largest empire in the world. The British ruled India until 1858. It was through the British East India Company, and then after the 1857 mutiny in 1858, Britain took over India directly. So Mill was a strong supporter of the British Empire, and he thought the British were at a higher stage of civilization with people in India, were entitled to rule them in order to bring them in line with the enlightened thought of, say, the people like him, and thought the Indian people in India have all these superstitious views, so we need to have the enlightened intellectuals come in and rule them, bring them benefits of civilization. In On Liberty, again, he says that the proposal, the libertarian-oriented proposal making for freedom of discussion, apply only to people who reach a certain stage of civilization. And before that, if people are at what he considers a primitive level, then it's all right, sort of enlightened despotism is really the best that can be expected. And this wasn't just a theoretical view that Mill had in saying, well, look, I think there are good things to be said for imperialism. Both James Mill and John Stuart Mill were high officials of the British East India Company. That's how John Stuart Mill earned his living for most of his life. He was a high official of the East India Company in London. He didn't go to India, but he was an official in the company's offices. Another area where Mill was different from most of the earlier Ricardians, but he was much less sympathetic to laissez-faire than most of the early Ricardians. He was thought socialism, in fact, might be a good idea, but he was opposed to centralized socialism. He favored a system of workers' cooperatives. And he was also, a view he had on policy, but he didn't think that continual technological progress was a good idea. Now, Stephen is right, and neither James Mill nor John didn't go to India. They just wrote about it or devised plans for ruling India, but they didn't go over themselves. They thought they could just learn about the country and just devise plans that would be best for the people there. He wasn't someone who said, well, as technology progresses and people come up with all these great inventions, we'll be able to live better. He liked the idea of a stationary state that wasn't growing, that then people would not concentrate on non-economic pursuits. So he thought that people would tend to overemphasize the benefits of productivity and material results, that people should really concentrate on intellectual pursuits, and that was much superior. Now, One view I just want to mention in conclusion, kind of controversial view, is that there's some people who think, as I say, this is a controversial view, I think Rothbard was sympathetic to this view, and also I know Ralph Rakowitz. Some people think that Mill, despite the reputation that On Liberty has as a defense of freedom of thought, some people think that what Mill really wanted was to have a class of intellectuals like himself in control of public opinion. So according to this view, Mill's ostensible libertarian arguments read On Liberty, you know, and give a strong defense of free speech. What he was really trying to do was to safeguard the views of intellectuals like himself from public criticism. So in this you say the message would be, well, don't put me in jail for talking about birth control, but he's not concerned so much with freedom for the masses. So in fact, he thought the masses should really be directed by their intellectual betters. Mill was influenced by the French sociologist, that man coined the word sociologist, Auguste Comte, who thought that public opinion should be really controlled, what he called an organic society, just like, say, you have a body, an organic body, the brain is in control of the limbs. He thought that really public opinion should be controlled. You shouldn't have all sorts of different views conflicting with each other. This is Comte's view, not Mill's view. But some people say, some scholars say, well, Mill was really influenced a lot by Comte. And however, on the other side, one should notice that Mill, sometimes very strongly critical of Comte, Comte had gone too far in favoring this organic society. Now, two of the main scholars who give this kind of anti-libertarian view of On Liberty say that Mill wasn't really interested so much in advancing freedom of thought in On Liberty, but really in control by an intellectual elite with Maurice Cowley and Joseph Hamburger. I think what they say is interesting, but to accept what they say, you have to read On Liberty in a fairly speculative way, because if you take it just the way from what it's saying, Mill doesn't say freedom of opinion should be restricted to this intellectual elite. So this is rather reading into the work, things that aren't explicitly said in it, but there is something to be said for this interpretation, but I just want to conclude, it is an interpretation, it isn't something you can just say, it is right there in the text, and you do have to be careful about that. Okay, so I think we'll stop there. So now we can have a question and answer. You can put it either in the chat or the Q&A, so I'll just click on the Q&A. Can send you to put anything there, but you can also put it in the chat in whatever you want, and I should be able to see it. Wait, here's a question here. I want to post up. Are there any books that can be read as a continuation of Rothbard's Austrian Perspective on the History of Economic Thought, Volume 1 and 2? Well, if you go to the, there aren't books, if you go to the Mises site, if you look in the Rothbard, there are some lectures he gave that would have been incorporated into volume, the third volume. I think he has some stuff on the Menger and Hayek and some other people, so I think that would probably be the best thing to look for it. As he said, can you say a bit more about why you feel J.F. Mill was a great philosopher? If he was, it is consistent with him being as poor an economist as Rothbard thought. Well, I think he has, why is it a great philosopher? Well, I think he has some very interesting things to say about the nature of necessity, what Newton's very critical of logical necessity, and I don't think he's right. He has kind of original views on that, and he has views on perception that are interesting. I think those are wrong to me. He has interesting views on religion. He's sometimes wrongly pictured as a complete opponent of religion, but he wasn't. Toward the end of his life, he believed in kind of a limited God, and he has some arguments for that. And I think this is consistent with being a poor economist. I mean, people can be good in one area and not others. I mean, Einstein was a great physicist, but he said some of the things he said about politics and economics were fairly foolish. So, I mean, you don't find always that someone who's good in one area is very good in others as well. Now let's see, here's another one here. J.S. Melville claimed to be somewhat libertarian, seems to have a desire to control his due present day liberal. Well, certainly that was the case in, say, population. He did have kind of an attitude that the masses are really people who have to be influenced by the elite intellectuals. If you accept this interpretation by Cowling and Joseph Hamburg, Linda Rader is another writer who got that you, and you would say, yes, even more that he really wants to control the population. He didn't have, although he made a place for rights in his work on utilitarianism, he didn't have a notion of natural rights, say, the way Rothbard understands it. So, he wouldn't have the view, say, everyone is a cell phone or like certain things that are impermissible to do to people, even if you're trying to promote the good. He was more, he was really catarring all sorts of interventions into people's freedom. Although he does have arguments that are in favor of free speech and freedom of opinion. Other sometimes economic freedom, but not consistently. Here's one from Steve. It would be fair to say that J.S. Mill's thinking would be more supportive of today's conservatism and libertarianism. Well, I think I would say that's an interesting question. I would say there's certain elements you might like in contemporary libertarianism, say stress on freedom of speech and freedom of people to live their own lives, at least if you reject this Cowling hamburger interpretation. But I don't think he was too sympathetic to conservatism. Say, if you look at the American conservatism today, if you have, say, he was not very favorable to Christianity, so he wouldn't like the evangelical very much. So I don't think he certainly didn't believe in laissez-faire capitalism either. So I would say he wouldn't be like either contemporary conservatives or libertarians. It would be hard to say which one he was furthest away from. Now, there is an interesting view, what your question reminded me, there's a book by Gertrude Himmelfarb where she thinks that Mill became after he had his nervous breakdown when he was 19, she thought he became more conservative after that. In a sense, she likes Mill for this period. She particularly likes Best Thing on Coleridge. And then she thinks after Mill became led into an intellectual emotional partnership with Harriet Taylor, he became abandoned what she thinks is a better conservative view, in that you're recognizing all sorts of conflicting values. And she thinks he then took a very oversimplified position in On Liberty, 1859, and later works. And she thought that Mill had a conservative period, but that was kind of a period of his younger years, and he shifted to a less conservative view. Here's one from Bob. Is it correct that the demand from labor, the derived demand, a functional demand for a commodity? Yes, I think that would be right, but it goes through the investment of the capitalist, but it doesn't directly determine demand for commodities. Just that, say, the capitalist is deciding what to invest, so, and then he's going to pay his workers out of the funds he saved up. But when he's deciding to invest, he's going to be asking how much of what he produces are people going to buy. So there's kind of a speculative estimate on his part of what demand is going to be. But it isn't, the current demand for his goods isn't determining the demand for labor at all, because workers are being paid not out of current spending, but out of the past funds the investor has accumulated. Incidentally, if you look at George Reisman's very massive book on capitalism, he has a very long discussion at this point. He thinks that was a fundamental insight. I think he has an essay on that. You can look in the Mises site, that just at least George Reisman had a discussion of that point on Mill, which I think is very good. He knows that essay, Mill, extremely well. But here's one. It seems like Mill and Comte's ideas about maps and direct range are for better. Is somewhat similar to Plato's orientation of society and the Republic, where they influenced by Plato. Of course, Mill had certainly read the Republic and thought highly of Plato. And he was learning Greek at an astonishingly early age. He was reading Greek when he was 6 years old. And one of his great friends and associate was George Grote, who was a great historian of Greek philosophy. But I think he didn't tend to interpret Plato as an authoritarian. He tended to view Plato as kind of a, he would stress his similarities with Socrates. The one Mill really admired in Greek philosophy was Socrates, and he regarded Socrates as kind of a model of intellectual inquiry. But I think you're right, there is that element kind of the intellectual elite who need to guide the less educated. It is something you find in Plato. I think you're right. That is one of the things. Yes, I think this idea has a democratic twist. It doesn't want to say you need a dictatorship, at least once society has come to a certain level of civilization, but the educated get more votes. So a democracy, kind of a modified democracy. Oh, we still have a little bit of time left. Anybody has something else? Have people read Mill much? Sometimes I don't think economic works are read too much today, but you very often get them in philosophy or history classes. I wondered if people read him. There's someone. Okay, here's one. Steve says, would it be true Jack Millington's British economics more so than economics generally, or French economics? Yes, I think that's right, although Mill did it. I mean, Mill was read in Europe, but there was a French tradition, which remember we were talking about in the earlier lecture, say, and then we'll be talking about it in the sixth lecture. It was rather independent, so I think Mill's principal influence was on economists in England, also in Ireland and Scotland. I mean, he was read though in Europe, and he was translated into German and French, so they all read him. But I think you're right that his influence in Britain was more than in some of the other countries, but he certainly had an international reputation. He was a very respected thinker all over the world. Nietzsche didn't like him. Bob, do any contemporaries you know as their guy? Well, there are philosophers who think very highly of him. Like there's one man at Cambridge, John Skorupski, who likes Mill. He's written a very long book on Mill, and he likes him. There was other philosophers, Fred Berger, who had a book on Mill that was very appreciative. Paul Feyerabend in philosophy of science, I think, thought very highly of Mill. I mean, I think most people like him would be wouldn't say view himself as strict millions, they just think he was an important thinker. Alessi said, what was Harriet Taylor's influence on Mill? Well, this is a much disputed topic. Remember, I mentioned Gertrude Himmelfarb holds the view that Harriet Taylor had kind of a bad influence on Mill. She made him oversimplify his thought, but there's a lot of dispute about that. Mill himself said he got a lot of his good ideas from Taylor, and she was really could be considered like a co-author of his works. But then there's some people who say that he just said that because he was so much in love with her that she really didn't contribute that much, or she wasn't that good. So that's much to be the topic. Friedrich Hayek actually wrote on this topic. He was interested in their correspondence. I think he published something on their correspondence. So Hayek was one who was interested in Harriet Taylor. But I think the usual view is that she wasn't that significant a figure in her own right, but there are people who rate her higher than that, especially some feminist historians tend to rate her higher than she it's really hard to say. Of course, after she died, then Mill lived with her daughter, not Mill's daughter, but she had been married to someone else before Mill. It was after that man died that Harriet Taylor and Mill married. Okay, so he said, you generally use Rothbard J.S. Mill as an economist in that he set back economic thinking for many years before men. But yes, I mean, I think that's a convincing view, because what Rothbard is saying is that people Ricardo was really wrong and people were coming to see that, but then because of Mill's influence, Ricardo came back and he thinks Mill had wrong views about economic methods. So I think it's right that he did set back economic thinking. Then when the marginalists came in, like W.S. Jevons, they were arguing explicitly against Mill and they were reacting against him. So I think they at least they were agreeing with Rothbard that there was a lot wrong with Mill. Not everybody in England thought that, but there was certainly some who did. It's funny the way, you know, the story of how Mill died. He had had this very strange illness called erysipelas, and I think his head exploded. I have to check that to be sure, but I believe it was something like that. Of course, I have to check that. There was some sort of inflammation or something. Happened very suddenly. Rather unusual way to go. And no, he's not mummified unlike Bentham. He died when he was in France. Mill throughout his life had spent a lot of time in France. He was very familiar with, spoke fluent French and had a lot of friends there. So. That was he died there. He had some sort of attack. Well, I guess we're out of time now. So, thanks a lot, everybody. Next week we'll be talking about Marx. Whatever we say about him, we're certainly not a wishy-washy person. John said, "Could you explain why Mill believed there were no laws of distribution?" Well, that's kind of a peculiar view he had. As I say, it doesn't fit very well with the rest of Ricardo's belief in Ricardianism. But he apparently thought, well, seems like there's some room for labor unions. So I think he liked the labor unions. He wanted to give them some room for action. So I think that's possibly why he stressed that. But it is very hard to see how he could say that consistently with his other views, but he did say that. Part of his belief in benefit workers' co-ops. Well, I mean, you could hold that workers' co-ops are a good idea and still think they're laws of distribution. You just think the capitalists or the landlord share should go to the workers' co-op, but possibly you could try to tie them in. I'm quiet breath, worrying on things. So, I mean, I wouldn't know enough to differ with Murray on Mill. Okay, so thank you, everybody. Hope to see you all next week. Thank you. Bye. Bye, everybody.